This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. A young Pacifica radio producer named Eve Corey sat down with Langston Hughes in the studios of WBAI station in New York City in 1963 and had a lovely conversation with the esteemed author. There's a photo of their encounter on the front page of the archives website at pacificaradioarchives.org. Miss Corey heard that we had preserved the recording as part of our preservation and access project and called the archives, the 1-800 number, to request a copy. Last December, we sent her a copy with our compliments in time for the holidays. Here is her message after hearing the interview for the first time in over 44 years.
Hello, Brian DeShazer. This is Eve Corey. I received the CDs of my interview with Langston Hughes, and it came just on Christmas Eve, and it was the best present that anyone could ever get. My hands were shaking when I opened the envelope, and the minute I heard Mr. Hughes' voice, it took me right back to that WBAI studio and to that entire experience, and I recalled where I was nervous and didn't know what to say, and the fact that he was just on top of everything, ready to fill in an instant when I faltered. But generally, for a new interviewer, I didn't do too badly. At any rate, I thank you most kindly. It was a gift beyond gifts.
And now, here's Eve Corey's 1963 interview with one of the most influential writers of the 20th century, Mr. Langston Hughes.
We kind of got you up this morning, or this afternoon. It's 4 o'clock, and you say that you first get up at 4.
Well, I work at night, you see, and so sometimes I don't start writing until 12 or 1 o'clock, because there's not much use trying to do anything that requires a great deal of concentration in New York in the daytime or in the early evening.
Especially when carpenters come in. What did you just told me?
My windows were being fixed, but that's only a minor interruption. One has usually many interruptions during the day. The phone rings 40 times. Strangers come by, relatives you haven't seen in 10 years.
They just drop in.
Drop in time. And you can't say no. So the result is that when peace and quiet settles down, it's usually around midnight, you see. Then I may try to, or usually do try to, do some serious writing.
Mm. Sort of the quiet time for you. And
yeah.
Then you spend the rest of the day doing what? When you have leisure time to use.
Oh, I don't seem to have too much, really. When I wake up, is usually 2 or 3 or sometimes even 4 o'clock, depending on whether I work through daylight or not, I read the mail. And the mail is, maybe sometimes a 2 or 3 hour task if one answers some of the letters immediately, because there's a rather heavy mail, and now that I'm writing for the New York Post, I get quite a deal of fan mail. And
what kind of letters do you get?
On the whole, very cordial and usually nice letters commenting on some aspect with which the writer agrees, but
I knew there was going to be a but.
There's always a few letters of disagreement and sometimes violent disagreement, and once in a while from people who are not very pro-civil rights, one gets angry and unsigned letters, Ku Klux Klan type of letters.
Really?
Yes.
Are these postmarked New York or?
Most of them are. Most of them seem to be Brooklyn.
Well, what do they disagree with? I mean, I'm sure it's not your prose.
Well, they disagree with decent housing for Negroes, for example. Let Negroes stay in Harlem, or why should they live all over New York? They got Harlem. And
you live in Harlem yourself?
I live in Harlem, which I like very much. And I stay there because I like it, but on the other hand, I would hate to be ghettoized against my will. And New York is not a ghetto. The colored people in New York do live more or less all over the city now, you see. So Harlem is no longer a place where you have to live if you don't want to, if you're colored. But I happen to like it very much. It's a very lively community, and so I live there. But many of my friends live in Park West Village in the 80s or down in the village or in Brooklyn or in the Bronx, you see. And there is, of course, housing difficulty still for colored peoples, but not anywhere near what they used to be.
Mm-hmm. You originally came from Joplin, Missouri. Did you move directly to Harlem?
Oh, no. I was just born in Joplin.
I see.
I don't even remember it. I've lived so many places since then.
Well, and you're a native New Yorker, almost.
Well, I've been here more or less off and on for at least 25 years.
But you would say your home.
Yes. New York is my home.
Worked as a seaman, and you went to West Africa and Europe, which sounds quite fascinating, especially the West Africa part.
Yeah, I had a wonderful series of trips and enjoyed them very much. And sometimes I wish I were a seaman again. You get to travel. On freight boats. I've never worked on passenger ships, but on freight boats they go rather leisurely, you know. And they stay in odd ports to which one would not otherwise be likely to visit. And
where?
Sometimes they stay for 8 or 10 days. Ports like Burutu up the Niger River, and Boma up the Congo River on this African trip, you know.
When was this? I mean, what?
Well, this was way back in 1925, I believe.
Quiet times.
Quite a time ago, yeah. Mm.
And quiet, not quite what West Africa is today.
Well, no, I've been back several times, you know. In fact, I was in Africa twice last year, in Nigeria, in Ghana, in Uganda. And it is a very wonderful and interesting continent now, with a great deal of advancement being achieved by the newly liberated nations.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you edited the poems from Black Africa?
Well, I collected a great many poems and short stories from Africa. I have been doing so over a period now of 6 or 8 years, and brought out an anthology called An African Treasury of Poetry and Prose a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now, this May, my collection of African poetry is coming out, called Poems from Black Africa.
This was the one you edited?
Yes, I edited it, mm-hmm. and it contains the major poets writing in English and the major poets writing in French, but translation difficulties they're not insurmountable, but they take a lot of doing, and so the French poets are not as well represented as those from Nigeria and Ghana and the other English-speaking African mm-hmm. countries.
What about, are there any talents, shall we say, poets, African poets, who write in some of the various African languages?
Yes, there are, and some of the poets are bilingual or even trilingual.
Mm.
I mean, for example, in Nigeria, most people speak one of the native languages, Yoruba or Igbo. And some of the writers write in Yoruba, and most of them are educated in English schools, you see, English language schools. And English is the sort of lingua franca between the tribal peoples anyway. I mean, the Igbos and the Yorubas cannot understand one another except when they talk in English. So it is the common language. It's the language of the newspapers of Nigeria and of Ghana. And so most of the literary people use English, and sometimes they write in their own native tongues as well.
How is the translation problem there, I mean, as far as putting the native dialect into English?
Well, it's not great. There are so many people who speak both tongues, you see.
Does it kind of lose in the translation, though?
Well, now, of course, I can't tell.
Don't know any of the
Don't know the African languages, no.
Mm-hmm. I see that you have a number of books for children on the market, and a book of jazz, first book of jazz.
Yes, I think that's perhaps the only history of jazz for children that's been written. There have been many excellent jazz books for adults, but I know of none for young
mm-hmm.
people.
Nor do I, come to think of it. Also, first book of rhythms, which... do you have these illustrated?
Yes, they are illustrated, mm-hmm. and they're part of the Franklin Watts first book series, a series designed to introduce young people, children, to subjects when they begin to be interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
They have some quite wonderful books, first book of stones, the first book of archaeology, and so on. And I have written, so far, 5 books in that series.
What started you on books for children?
Well, I was asked to, if I would consider writing those particular books. And
somehow it seems that it would be natural. Children, I think, would very much like to read the simple stories. There's a certain warmth about them that would appeal to children.
Yes,
as well
a lot
as
of
to
the
adults.
High school youngsters seemingly are acquainted with my simple character.
Just been published, I believe, Something in Common.
Yes.
Which is a selection of stories.
Well, it's derived from two previous collections of short stories of mine and includes 11 new ones that have never been in book form before.
The simple stories have been.
Oh, yes, simple stories have been in book form, mm-hmm. but none of the simple stories are here. These are the more or less straight short stories that I've written over the years, and it includes one of my stories, which has been anthologized a great many times, and perhaps is my best-known short story. It's called A Good Job Gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like something I'd like to hear. Would you like to give us a little bit of that?
No, that one is a little bit too long, I think, to read here. It was originally published in Esquire years ago, but I would prefer reading a shorter one today, if I might. Shall I read it now?
Yes, sure. Go right ahead.
All right. The first story in the book is called Thank You, Ma'am. She was a large woman with a large purse that had everything in it but a hammer and nails. It had a long strap, and she carried it slung across her shoulder. It was about 11 o'clock at night, dark, and she was walking alone when a boy ran up behind her and tried to snatch her purse. The strap broke with a single sudden tug that the boy gave it from behind, but the boy's weight and the weight of the purse combined caused him to lose his balance. Instead of taking off full blast as he had hoped, the boy fell on his back on the sidewalk and his legs flew up. The large woman simply turned around and kicked him right square in his blue-jeaned sitter. Then she reached down, picked the boy up by his shirt front, and shook him until his teeth rattled. After that, the woman said, "Pick up my pocketbook, boy, and give it here." She held him tightly, but she bent down enough to permit him to stoop and pick up her purse. Then she said, "Now ain't you ashamed of yourself?" Firmly gripped by his shirt front, the boy said, "Yes'm." The woman said, "What did you want to do it for?" The boy said, "I didn't aim to." She said, "You a lie." By that time, two or three people passed, stopped, turned around on the street to look, and some stood watching. "If I turn you loose, will you run?" asked the woman. "Yes'm," said the boy. "Then I won't turn you loose," said the woman. She did not release him. "Lady, I'm sorry," whispered the boy. "Your face is dirty. I got a great mind to wash your face. Ain't you got nobody home, boy, to tell you to wash your face?" "No'm," said the boy. "Then it will get washed this evening," said the large woman, starting up the street, dragging the frightened boy behind her. He looked as if he were 14 or 15, frail and willow wild in tennis shoes and blue jeans. The woman said, "You ought to be my son. I would teach you right from wrong. Least I can do right now is to wash your face. Are you hungry?" "No'm," said the being dragged boy. "I just want you to turn me loose." "Was I bothering you when I turned that corner?" asked the woman. "No'm." "But you put yourself in contact with me," said the woman. "If you think that that contact is not going to last a while, you got another thought coming. When I get through with you, sir, you are going to remember Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones." Sweat popped out on the boy's face, and he began to struggle. Mrs. Jones stopped, jerked him around in front of her, put a half Nelson around his neck, and continued to drag him up the street. When she got to her door, she dragged the boy inside, down a hall, and into a large kitchenette-furnished room at the rear of the house. She switched on the light and left the door open. The boy could hear other roomers laughing and talking in the large house. Some of their doors were open, too, so he knew that he and the woman were not alone. The woman still had him by the neck in the middle of her room. She said, "What's your name?" "Roger," answered the boy. "Then, Roger, you go to that sink and wash your face," said the woman. Whereupon she turned him loose at last. Roger looked at the door, looked at the woman, looked at the door, and went to the sink. "Let the water run until it gets warm," she said. "Here's a clean towel." You going to take me to jail? Asked the boy, bending over the sink. Not with that face. I would not take you nowhere, said the woman. Here I am trying to get home to cook me a bite to eat, and you snatch my pocketbook. Maybe you ain't been to your supper either, late as it is. Have you? There's nobody home in my house, said the boy. Then we'll eat, said the woman. I believe you're hungry, or been hungry, to try to snatch my pocketbook. I want a pair of blue suede shoes, said the boy. Well, you didn't have to snatch my pocketbook to get some blue suede shoes, said Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones. You could have asked me. Ma'am? The water dripping from his face, the boy looked at her. There was a long pause, a very long pause. After he had dried his face, and not knowing what else to do, dried it again, the boy turned around, wondering what next. The door was open. He could make a dash for it down the hall. He could run, 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 run. The woman was sitting on the daybed. After a while, she said, I were young once, and I wanted things I could not get. There was another long pause. The boy's mouth opened. Then he frowned, not knowing he frowned. The woman said, uh-huh. You thought I was going to say but, didn't you? You thought I was going to say, but I didn't snatch people's pocketbooks. Well, I wasn't going to say that. Pause. Silence. I have done things, too, which I would not tell you, son. Neither tell God if he didn't already know. Everybody's got something in common. So you sit on a while I go and fix us something to eat. You might run that comb through your hair so you'll look presentable. In another corner of the room, behind a screen, was a gas plate and an icebox. Mrs. Jones got up and went behind the screen. The woman did not watch the boy to see if he was going to run now, nor did she watch her purse, which he left behind her on the daybed. But the boy took care to sit on the far side of the room, away from the purse, where he thought she could easily see him out of the corner of her eye if she wanted to. He did not trust the woman not to trust him, and he did not want to be mistrusted now. "Do you need somebody to go to the store?" asked the boy. "Maybe to get some milk or something?" "I don't believe I do," said the woman, "unless you just want sweet milk yourself. I was going to make cocoa out of this canned milk I got here." "That will be fine," said the boy. She heated some lima beans and ham she had in the icebox, made the cocoa, and set the table. The woman did not ask the boy anything about where he lived, or his folks, or anything else that would embarrass him. Instead, as they ate, she told him about her job in a hotel beauty shop that stayed open late at night, what the work was like, and how all kinds of women came in and out, blondes, redheads, and Spanish. Then she cut him a half of her 10-cent cake. "Eat some more, son," she said. When they were finished eating, she got up and said, "Now here, take this $10 and buy yourself some blue suede shoes. And next time, do not make the mistake of latching on to my pocketbook nor nobody else's, because shoes got by devilish ways will burn your feet. I got to get my rest now, but from here on in, son, I hope you will behave yourself." She led him down the hall to the front door and opened it. "Good night. Behave yourself, boy," she said, looking out into the street as he went down the steps. The boy wanted to say something other than "thank you, ma'am," to Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones. But although his lips moved, he couldn't even say that as he turned at the foot of the barren stoop and looked up at the large woman in the doorway. Then she shut the door. That is the end.
Oh, we can't end it here. Would you try one more for us, perhaps?
That was well, wonderful. Let's see if I can find another short one. Mm. Both of these stories are stories I've written within the last 2 years. There was quite a long period when I didn't write short stories. I suppose I was so busy working on plays and longer kinds of creative things that the short story form didn't have much time left for it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But of late, I've written perhaps half a dozen short stories in the last 2 years, and this one is called Sorrow for a Midget. It's another story laid in Harlem, and
There are 37 stories in all in this.
37 stories in the book, yes. Mm-hmm. And a number of them are longer than these that I'm reading now. This one is told through the eyes of a hospital worker. And you know we've all been reading about the hospital problems of low wages and poor staffs, you know. So this young man was not really dedicated to his work, but he got this job in the hospital, and so he tells this story. No grown man works in a hospital if he can help it. The pay is too low. But I was broke, jobs hard to find, and the employment office sent me there that winter, right in the middle of Harlem. Work wasn't hard, just cleaning up the wards, serving meals off a rolling table, bullying around, pushing a mop. I didn't mind. I got plenty of rest. Got plenty to eat, too. It was a little special kind of hospital. There was three private rooms on my floor, and in one of them was a female midget. Miss Midget. A little lady who looked like a dried-up child to me. But they told me, so that I wouldn't get scared of her, that she was a midget. She had a pocketbook bigger than she was. It laid on a chair beside her bed. Generous, too. Nice, that little midget lady. She gave me a tip the first day I was there. But she was dying. The nurses told me Countess Midget was booked to die. And I'd never seen nobody die. Anyway, I hung around her. It was profitable. Take care of me good, she said. I pay as I go. I always did know how to get service. She opened her big fat pocketbook as big as she was and showed me a thick wad of bills. This gets it any time, anywhere, she said. It got it with me, all right. I stuck by. Tips count up. That's how I know so much about what happened in them few days she was in that hospital room. Game as she could be, but booked to die. Not even penicillin can save her, the day nurse said. Not her. That was when penicillin was new. Of course, the undertakers that year was all complaining about penicillin. They used to come to the hospital looking for corpses. Business is bad, one undertaker told me. People don't die like they used to since this penicillin come in. Uh-uh. Springtime in the old days, you could always count on plenty of folks dying of pneumonia and such, going outdoors catching cold before it was warm enough and all. Funerals every other day we used to have then. Not no more. The doctors stick 'em with penicillin now, and they get well. Damn if they don't. Penicillin is bad for morticians. But that midget did not have pneumonia, neither a cold. She had went without an operation she needed too long. Now, operations could do her no good. And what they put in the needle for her arm was not penicillin. It was something that did her no good either, just eased down the pain. It were kept locked up, so young orderlies like me would not steal it and sell it to junkies. The nurses would not even tell me where it was locked up at. You know, I did not look too straight when I come in that hospital. They was short-handed, not having much help, so they would hire almost anybody for an orderly in a hospital in Harlem, even me. So I got the job. Right off, after that first day, I loved that midget. I said, little bitch, you're a game, kitty. I admire your spunk. Midget said, I dig this hospital jive. Them nurses ain't understandable. Nice, but don't understand. You're the only one in here, boy, I would ask to do me a favor. Fine, my son. You look like a baby to me, midget. Where and when on earth did you get a son? I asked. Don't worry about that, said Countess Midget. I got him, and he's mine. I want him right now. He do not know I am in here sick. If he did, he would come, even were he ashamed of the way he looked. You find my son. She gave me $20 for subway fare and taxi to go looking. I went and searched and found her son. Just like she had said he might be, he were ashamed to come to the hospital. He was not doing so well. Fact is, her son was ragged as a buzzard, feeding on a Lenox Avenue carcass. But when I told him his mama was sick in the Maggie Butler Pavilion of the Sadie Henderson Hospital, he come. He got right up out of bed and left his girlfriend and come. My mama has not called me for a long, long time, he said. If she calls me now, like this boy says, he told his girl, wild horses could not hold me. Maybe I'm going to see my mama, he said. I did not know you even had a mama, whined the sleepy old broad in the bed, looking as if she did not much care. Lots of things you do not know about this, Joe, said the cat to the broad. He got up and dressed and went with me, quick. That little bitty woman, I asked him in the street, is she your mama? Damn right she's my mama, said the guy, who was near 6 feet tall, big, heavy-set, black and ragged. No warm coat on. I thought I was beat, but he was the most. I could tell he had been gone to the dogs, long gone. Still, he was a young man. From him, I took a lesson. I will never get this far down, I said to myself. No, not ever get this far down and out. Is she very low sick, he asked about his mama. Real sick? Man, I don't know, I said. She is sunk way down in bed, and the sign on the door says, no visitors. Then how am I going to get in? Relatives is not visitors, I said. Besides, I know the nurses. Right now is not even visiting hours, too early. But come with me. You'll get in. I felt sorry for a guy with a mama who was a midget who was dying in the hospital. A midget laying dying. Had she been my mama, I guess I would have wanted to be there, though, in spite of the fact she was a midget. I couldn't help wondering how could she be so small and have this great big son. Who was his papa? And how could his papa have had her? Well, anyhow, I took him in to see the little countess in that big high hospital bed, so dark and small, in that white, white room, in that white bed. They had just given his mama a needle, so she were not right bright. But when she saw her son, her little old wrinkled face lighted up, her little old tiny matchstick arms went almost around his neck, and she hollered, my baby, real loud, my precious baby son, my son. Mama, he almost cried, I have not been a good son to you. You have been my only son, she said. The nurse hit me. Let's get out of here and leave him alone. So the nurse and I went out and left him alone. We left him alone for a long time until he left. That afternoon, that midget died. Her son couldn't hardly have more than gotten back home when I had to go after him again. I asked him on the way back to the hospital this time, was he honest to God, sure enough, her son? He shook his head, no. That is when I felt most sorry for that midget, when I heard him say, no. He explained to me that he was just a took-in son, one she had sort of adopted when he was near about a baby, because he had no father and no mother, and she had no son. But she wanted people to think she had a son. She was just his midget mama, that's all. He never had no real mama that he knew. But this little tiny midget raised him as best she could. Being mostly off in sideshows and carnivals the biggest part of the time, she boarded him out somewhere in school in the country. When he got teenage and come back to Harlem, he went right straight to the dogs. But she loved him, and he loved her. When he found out, about 5:30 p.m. that afternoon, that she had died, that big old ragged, no-good, make-believe son of hers cried like a child.
Oh, don't close the book now. Do we have another little short one?
Well, I don't have any more real short ones. The others are rather long, I think, too.
Wonderful. You know, Something in Common sounds like a great title for a play as well. And you've written some wonderful plays, Tambourines to Glory.
Yes.
Which is now Simply Heavenly, certainly.
Simply Heavenly had quite a little run on Broadway, you know.
Mm-hmm. Soul Gone Home.
And the lyrics for Street Scene.
Which is going to be done.
Which is being done now at the
Lincoln Center
as a part of the opera repertoire, yes. Yeah.
Have you thought of doing something with Something in Common, or is it too early yet?
To tell the truth, I hadn't thought of
it. Because it sounds
of
the characters.
Using these stories for plays. They do have rather, I guess what you might call a common theme running through a number of them, and
They have something in common.
Yes, the attempt is to show that practically all human beings, white, colored, whatever race they may be, or whatever social stratification they may come from, have something in common.
I'd like to ask something about the fight for freedom, which is
has won the story of the NAACP.
Yes, which has won a great deal of acclaim. This is out now.
It's out, and it's been out for several months, and it's about a very timely subject. It's about the integration struggle and the background to the current problems in the South, and it encompasses really the whole history of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is the largest and leading Negro organization in the country, or Negro and white, it's really interracial organization, attempting to straighten out our democratic problems in reference to race. And, of course, as you know, very great progress has been made in the last decade. On the legal front, almost all of this progress has been due to the National Association, the NAACP, because it was their lawyers, their legal staff, their planning that brought about the Supreme Court decisions, you know, that opened up the schools to all, that brought about the end of restrictive covenants, again, through legal decisions. And many people do not realize that much of this progress in this area of civil rights benefits not only the Negro people, but benefits many other minorities as well. For example, in housing, right here in New York, in Brooklyn, in fact, there were housing cases where Armenian families were not permitted to rent apartments in certain localities. Even Italians sometimes, there are neighborhoods that refused to rent or sell to them. And the Jewish people, of course, have had many problems in that regard, not so much in the New York area as in Florida and some parts of our South. Neighborhoods have signs that I've seen myself restricted, and those signs were not
in Florida.
Yes, they were not against Negroes. You see many signs, colored, not admitted, and so on in the South, but the restricted signs, when I first saw them, I said, what do they mean? And they said, oh, that means no Jewish people here. And, of course, when the Supreme Court ruled such housing covenants and plans to restrict people to ghetto areas were illegal, it was a victory for many other peoples than the Negroes, you know? People who took part in the legal planning, the lynching investigations back in the old days when we had around 1920, almost a lynching a week. There was one year in which there were more than 52 lynchings, one every week. And many of the lynchings were by burnings. Young people nowadays who didn't live through that period don't remember that people were burned at the stake in the public square without trial. Human barbecues, really, you know? And so when you realize the kind of savagery that went on 25 or 30 years ago, you can see that we have at least made some progress, that they don't conduct lynchings anymore, at least not openly. Mississippi or Texas, and the police dogs may tear your trousers off, but they don't chew you to death.
They get a little skin every once in a while.
Yes, they do.
Yes. You did win the Springarn Medal for this, didn't you?
Well, not specifically for that book. The Springarn Medal is given for, I guess, for one's overall achievement, but I happened to receive it during the year in which that book was about to appear.
That was recently, wasn't it?
About two years ago, I believe. The book has been out now perhaps almost a year.
Are you an officer with the NAACP?
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm not at all. It was a commissioned book. I was asked to write it, and I very much enjoyed writing it in a way. I mean, I acquired much information myself that I did not have before. But I must say it was the most difficult literary job that I've ever done, in that it required so much research and so much reading and so much careful checking.
It's a complete evaluation.
And it's a factual book, you see. And I am primarily really a poet and a fiction writer, and it's much easier to make something up out of your own head than it is to do a lot of research. I'll have to work that hard to put it together.
Well, aside from making things up out of your own head, your characters certainly bear a tremendous amount of resemblance to a lot of people I have seen. I just wonder, where do you find them?
Well, they're not copies of exact people, but they're composites oftentimes of people that I have known myself or certainly know about, or sometimes I use stories that I've heard as a basis for a fiction story, but changing and usually extending and elaborating on the tale as I've heard it, you know?
Mm. Well, I really can't wait to finish the Something in Common, and
It's now in paperback and hardcover, mm-hmm. and available, I believe, in most of the large paperback shops or bookshops around about. And it has just recently come out, so I have not seen any reviews yet. I don't know what the critics will say about it, but authors, I hope they'll say something good.
Well, thank you very, very much. Perhaps we'll hear some simple stories at another time.
Oh, I'd be delighted sometime to read some of them, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a 1963 conversation between author Langston Hughes and Pacifica producer Eve Corey, right here on From the Vault. And that does it for this week's program. From the Vault is produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project.